From Chicago, this is Democracy Now! President Clinton's love affair with his right-wing advisor Dick Morris is over, at least for now. The president addresses Democratic delegates and the nation.
Here's the main idea. I love and revere the rich and proud history of America. And I am determined to take our best traditions into the future. But with all respect, we do not need to build a bridge to the past. We need to build a bridge to the future. And that is what I commit to you to do.
Some wonder if you believe that, he'll sell you the Brooklyn Bridge. And the whole world was not watching. We'll talk to members of the Chicago 11, protesters arrested at the 1996 Democratic Convention. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman, here with Salim Wakil. He is the senior editor at In These Times and a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times. President Clinton accepted the Democratic Party's nomination for president last night before a packed arena of delegates, media, employees, and friends. Throughout the speeches, and throughout President Clinton's speech in particular, pundits prowled the skyboxes, sharing their commentary with audiences, often spewing the same old tired nonsense. My favorite was CNN's commentary. The Republican said she didn't like the saying, "It takes a village," you know, the title of Hillary Clinton's book, because it suggested to her polygamy and tribalism. So we hightailed it out of the convention. We decided to go somewhere else and headed two blocks away from the United Center to one of the toughest, most desperate examples of public housing in America. We invited a group of Henry Horner residents and people who work at the project to join us for Clinton's speech. Here is what he had to say and what they said.
10 million new jobs, over half of them high-wage jobs. 10 million workers getting the raise they deserve with the minimum wage law. 25 million people now having protection in their health insurance because the Kennedy-Kassebaum bill says you can't lose your insurance anymore when you change jobs, even if somebody in your family's been sick. 40 million Americans with more pension security, a tax cut for 15 million of our hardest working, hardest pressed Americans, and all small businesses. 12 million Americans, 12 million of them, taking advantage of the family and medical leave law so they can be good parents and good workers. 10 million students have saved money on their college loans. We are making our democracy work.
To me, the most important issue that I did not hear him talk on was public housing as a whole. Where's it going? What are they going to do with it? Public housing is going to exist. You're going to continue to have low-income families, even though he has a welfare reform bill that's still not going to stop low income. Most of the jobs that are going to be out there are probably going to be minimum wage. They're not going to be able to afford $800 apartments. So does that stop? Does the money stop from the government for low-income housing or not?
Do you think a president could do anything that would change the condition of, say, some of the housing developments in the city?
A president alone, yes. I basically think that he's doing reform bills in other areas. He needs to do a reform bill for public housing. Public housing needs more money to operate. We need more money to redevelop. We need more money to enable the residents, to give them, as Mr. Pittman said, a better quality of life. But that has to be done with, we don't have the means as it stands right now. And no one's talking about that. Everyone's talking about tearing down, but not necessarily how, when, where they're going to rebuild.
What do you think are the major issues that are going on that prevent the quality of life from being improved?
Well, I think the biggest one is education. And jobs.
We must make 2 years of college just as universal in 4 years as a high school education is today. And we can do it. We can do it, and we should cut taxes to do it. I propose a $1,500 a year tuition tax credit for Americans, a HOPE scholarship for the first 2 years of college to make the typical community college education available to every American. Thank you. I believe every working family ought also to be able to deduct up to $10,000 in college tuition costs per year for education after that. I believe the families of this country ought to be able to save money for college in a tax-free IRA, save it year in and year out, withdraw it for college education without penalty. We should not tax middle-income Americans for the money they spend on college. We'll get the money back down the road many times over. I want to say here, before I go further, that these tax cuts and every other one I mentioned tonight are all fully paid for in my balanced budget plan, line by line, dime by dime, and they focus on education. Now, one thing so many of our fellow Americans are learning is that education no longer stops on graduation day. I have proposed a new GI Bill for American workers, a $2,600 grant for unemployed and underemployed Americans so that they can get the training and the skills they need to go back to work at better paying jobs, good, high-skilled jobs for a good future.
A lot of people don't have access to education. To get a college education today, it's very expensive, and a lot of people do not have the money or the resources to pursue a college education. Over in the Henry Horner Development, we personally work with a lot of teenagers, and a lot of teenagers go to college for their first year or the first quarter of their freshman year, and it's so expensive that they cannot return after the first quarter, after the first semester. They find themselves in the military or just back in the development with a dead-end job, a minimum wage job, and we see it every day.
The welfare reform law I signed last week gives America a chance, but not a guarantee, to have that kind of new beginning, to have a new social bargain with the poor, guaranteeing health care, child care, and nutrition for the children, but requiring able-bodied parents to work for the income. Now I say to all of you, whether you supported the law or opposed it, but especially to those who supported it, we have a responsibility, we have a moral obligation to make sure the people who are being required to work have the opportunity to work. We must make sure the jobs are there. There should be 1 million new jobs for welfare recipients by the year 2000. States under this law can now take the money that was spent on the welfare check and use it to help businesses provide paychecks. I challenge every state to do it soon. I propose also to give businesses a tax credit for every person hired off welfare and kept employed. I propose to offer private job placement firms a bonus for every welfare recipient they place in a job who stays in it. And more important, I want to help communities put welfare recipients to work right now without delay, repairing schools, making their neighborhoods clean and safe, making them shine again. There's lots of work to be done out there. Our cities can find ways to put people to work and bring dignity and strength back to these families.
What did you think when President Clinton said in a speech that they're going to provide a tax credit if an owner of a business hired a person off welfare?
Well, I think that's it's okay. You know, I think that it's at least an idea. I've heard it before. You know, this is not the first time I've heard it. I think I hear it most elections. During most elections, I hear that. But, you know, I've seen it take place on a very small degree, and it works. I think a lot of people, we have to get past a lot of things. A lot of people are actually afraid to hire public housing residents. They're afraid, and we have to get past a lot of myths and a lot of fears.
Why afraid?
Because of the myth that exists about public housing residents. Public housing residents are not viewed as quote-unquote normal people. They're viewed as some separate entity within our society. They don't think like the rest of society thinks. They don't do things the way the society thinks. You know, they don't do things the way society deems that they should do things. So there's a myth that goes around, and we see it every day. And we hear it every day. We feel it every day.
My fellow Americans, I have spent an enormous amount of time with our dear friend, the late Ron Brown, and with Secretary Cantor and others, opening markets for America around the world. And I'm proud of everyone we opened. But let us never forget, the greatest untapped market for American enterprise is right here in America, in the inner cities, in the rural areas who have not felt this recovery. With investment and business and jobs, they can become our partners in the future. And it's a great opportunity we ought not to pass up. I propose more empowerment zones like the one we have right here in Chicago to draw business into poor neighborhoods. I propose more community development banks like the South Shore Bank right here in Chicago to help people in those neighborhoods start their own small businesses. More jobs, more incomes, new markets for America right here at home, making welfare reform a reality. Now, folks, you cheered, and I thank you. But the government can only do so much. The private sector has to provide most of these jobs. So I want to say again, tonight I challenge every business person in America who has ever complained about the failure of the welfare system to try to hire somebody off welfare and try hard. Thank you. I want to build a bridge to the 21st century that ends the permanent underclass, that lifts up the poor and ends their isolation, their exile, and they're not forgotten anymore.
When President Clinton says in this new welfare law that that no person can be on welfare more than 5 years in their lifetime, that no person can be on welfare more than 3 months, I think they're saying in a three-month period, what will that do to your neighbors? What will that do? How will that affect life, for example, at Henry Horner?
We have a lot more homeless people.
People that would even have to move out of Henry Horner?
I would think, as far as families would go, I would think more families would be displaced because of that. I mean, if you cut somebody off, if you got someone who has no education, no skills whatsoever, and you tell them, okay, go out there and get you a job, you got 2 years to go find your job. In that two-year time, you gotta get an education first. You gotta get some kind of skill to get a job. And I don't think there'll be no way you can do it in 2 years and then be off. Then what? So you mean to tell me because I couldn't find a job in two? I know people who've been working who have skills, who haven't found a job in 10 years. So are you trying to tell me after 2 years you're gonna put this woman and her children out in the streets because she couldn't find a job? You think that's gonna work? That's gonna help us? How's it helping? has hurt more than helping.
You share the same thoughts on that?
Exactly.
Uh-huh. So do you think this is going to be a disaster?
I think it needs to be some more reform.
It needs a little bit more work.
Needs a little more. Back to the drawing board.
If President Clinton were sitting here right now, what would you tell him?
I would tell him to basically do what he says he's going to do. That's what I would tell him.
In our own country, we have seen America pay a terrible price for any form of discrimination. And we have seen us grow stronger as we have steadily let more and more of our hatreds and our fears go. As we have given more and more of our people the chance to live their dreams. That is why the flame of our Statue of Liberty, like the Olympic flame carried all across America by thousands of citizen heroes, will always, always burn brighter than the fires that burn our churches, our synagogues, our mosques. Always. Look around this hall tonight, and to our fellow Americans watching on television, you look around this hall tonight. There is every conceivable difference here among the people who are gathered. If we want to build that bridge to the 21st century, we have to be willing to say loud and clear, if you believe in the values of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, if you're willing to work hard and play by the rules, you are part of our family, and we're proud to be with you. You cheer now because you know this is true. You know this is true. When you walk out of this hall, think about it. Live by it. We still have too many Americans who give in to their fears of those who are different from them. Not so long ago, swastikas were painted on the doors of some African-American members of our special forces at Fort Bragg. Folks, for those of you who don't know what they do, the special forces are just what the name says. They are special forces. If I walk off this stage tonight and call them on the telephone and tell them to go halfway around the world and risk their lives for you and be there by tomorrow at noon, they will do it. They do not deserve to have swastikas on their doors. So, look around here. Look around here. Old or young. Healthy as a horse or a person with a disability that hadn't kept you down. Man or woman. Native American, Native born, immigrant. Straight or gay. Whatever. The test ought to be, I believe in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Declaration of Independence. I believe in religious liberty. I believe in freedom of speech. I believe in working hard and playing by the rules. I'm showing up for work tomorrow. I'm building that bridge to the 21st century. That ought to be the test.
Is there a black and a white Chicago? Would you say that there are two different worlds, or that it's integrated here? You're laughing, Michael Jordan.
Yes, there is.
I've always said there is a black and white Chicago.
Can you describe the two communities?
There is a Forest Park school, grammar school, with brand new books. There is Chicago Henry Horner School with Forest Park's old books. There is a playground, a park with new swings. There are poles where swings used to be. There's a black and there's a white Chicago.
President Clinton says he wants to build a bridge into the next century. Do you think he could build a bridge between the communities? Do you think that's possible? Do you think you'll see that in your lifetime?
I think it's going to take a lot longer than another 4 years.
Do you expect anytime soon to see an African-American president?
I do.
Henry Horner resident Michael Jordan and Shirley McLemore and Dana Pittman. They both work at the Henry Horner Homes. They work with the Chicago Housing Authority. Oh, yes, and of course, President Bill Clinton. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman with Salim Muakil. The Democratic National Convention is over, and so for the moment, we'll all be spared the flag waving, the glitz, the empty rhetoric, and most importantly, the Macarena.
Well, why the Macarena? Well, the song projects a hip, energetic, multi-culti image of the Democratic Party on national TV. It also reminds America that the Democrats oppose English-only laws, since the song was originally all in Spanish. But you have to wonder if the political handlers who designed this convention bothered to listen to the lyrics.
I am not trying to seduce you.
Give your body happiness, Macarena. That your body is to give happiness and pleasure. Give your body happiness, Macarena. Hey, Macarena.
So that's what they were singing
that's
and dancing to at
saying.
The Democratic Convention.
So
you
appropriate.
Know, we should say that they were also dancing at the Republican Convention, not quite as much. In fact, Jack Kemp danced the Macarena on the podium. Oh, well, so much for English only. Well, Dick Morris has done the Macarena right out of the White House. Morris, the sleazy and widely hated political strategist, is credited for Clinton's innovative election year strategy of stealing the Republican agenda and calling it New Democrat. On the most important day of President Clinton's reelection campaign, Morris submitted his resignation after Rupert Murdoch's New York Post published a story that the tabloid The Star was going to come out with a story claiming that for the past year, the married Morris was paying a prostitute $200 an hour to engage in kinky sex. Kind of makes you wonder what hourly rate Morris was charging Clinton for his controversial advice. We know the last check he got was something like $200,000. Well, who is Dick Morris? He's Clinton's right-hand man. He pushes tax cuts and warns Clinton about getting too close to people of color. He's worked for Mississippi Republican Trent Lott and North Carolina's Jesse Helms, among others. And according to author-journalist Bob Woodward, Morris suggested to Massachusetts Governor William Weld, whom he also worked for, that he should run against Clinton, who he was being paid for at the time, saying the president would be indicted over Whitewater. Well, we thought we would get a comment on these developments from a well-known columnist and author, Katha Pollitt of The Nation magazine. Katha, I just wanted to get your take on the Dick Morris sex scandal.
Well, it's another tale of family values. Get down on all fours and bark like a dog for your hooker lady love.
I was talking to Bobby Rush, the Black Panther turned congressman from Illinois earlier today, and he said he thinks this is a Republican plot, obviously, to go after Clinton on the day that he's making this big address, not only to the convention, but to the nation. And he includes Dick Morris in that plot.
It is hard to believe that Dick Morris himself would have set up being quoted in the New York Post as being on all fours like a dog and saying, isn't this fun? I mean, presumably the guy has some kind of dignity and some kind of life outside of wanting to fall on his sword to this extent for the Republican Party.
Well, let me ask you, not so much on the sex scandal issue, but the effect of Dick Morris on the White House. This is a man who is a longtime Republican, actually helping people on both sides of the aisle, which suggests
Yes.
they may not be an aisle at all, but from working for Senator Jesse Helms to Trent Lott of Mississippi, you can't get much more conservative than that, telling William Weld to run for president because President Clinton is going to be indicted for Whitewater. This is the man that President Clinton has been having, I guess you could say, an affair with since the early 1980s when he helped him come back to get the governorship after he had lost it once in Arkansas. What do you think this will mean for President Clinton's politics? Is he a right-winger anyway? Clinton boasting in the last week that he has been fighting for, you know, welfare reform for the last 15 years. So actually Dick Morris doesn't matter, and he's just a scapegoat. When people say he's going too right-wing, you say, it's Dick Morris. Or, you know, this will actually change politics at the White House.
Well, Clinton hired Dick Morris. You know, Dick Morris didn't come out from the ocean like a sea monster and take over the White House. So that tells you something right there. I think, you know, what you're saying really speaks to this very deep-seated desire on the part of liberals and people who now are calling themselves progressives to believe that what's happening isn't really happening. It's all a bad dream. It's all someone has eaten Bill Clinton's brain. Bill Clinton was going on about ending welfare as we know it when he was a candidate the first time. So I don't let him off the hook. I don't want to say that, you know, this is Dick Morris being Svengali here. I think it was more, there was a wonderful quote in Time magazine that said that Dick Morris freed Clinton to be the benevolent father. You know, that he took on the burden of all this, nuts and bolts political calculation, enabling Clinton to think about weighty matters like smoking, you know. But actually, they're very similar. They're both very calculating political figures, and they both come trailing an aura of shady sex scandals. They seem very similar to me.
What do you think about the idea that the Clinton administration's success at squelching any kind of dissent at the Democratic convention, you know, around welfare repeal and other issues, is actually going to lead to is President Clinton's downfall, at least at this convention, if not in November? Because since there hasn't been any controversy, the press is hungry for something like this and then just pounces on it when it happens. And that possibly, you know, well, I won't say because this is going to come out tomorrow, you know, President Clinton might well be wishing that there was now a welfare repeal protest on the floor of the convention to divert some of the attention.
Well, you know, it's my belief, and you can call this cynical if you like, that the kind of people who become politicians are the kind of people who do a lot of things in private life that are to many ordinary people shocking and distasteful, if not actually illegal. And I believe that hiring a prostitute is illegal, isn't it? I would say the Republicans have to worry about this too. You know, I mean, there are a lot of stories going around. And the best defense, of course, is not to do bad things. But I just want to say, and I don't want you to take this as, you know, oh, I'm for Clinton, so I'm trying to say something bad about a Republican in order so that everyone will forget the Dick Morris thing, which I think they'll do anyway. But it is the case that, according to a recent story in the Village Voice, when Senator Dole got his divorce, he was making $115,000, and his wife, who had put him together after that famous war wound, and born him a child, and lived with him through his whole political career and suffered greatly, got $18,000 in alimony after all of that. And there were a lot of shenanigans around that divorce. So, I mean, what does that say about family values?
Katha Pollitt, she is a columnist for The Nation magazine. Her book is called Reasonable Creatures. We talked to her yesterday just after the Dick Morris scandal broke. But you know, Salim, though we were talking about the sex scandal, his cavorting with a prostitute, and at least in the beginning, who charged $200 an hour, although some might say, who is the prostitute here? And we extend that to President Clinton. When you're talking about the amount of money that he gets from corporate lobbyists, as we've been following all week, to determine legislation. But I think the most important thing is who Dick Morris is, and the fact that President Clinton has hired him off and on since the early 1980s, and he goes across the spectrum.
Yes, and you know, it's, again, very appropriate that a campaign that depended so much on symbolism should be in the convention's last days be afflicted with such a classic symbol of what people are alleging about the Clinton administration.
Well, you know, we went inside the convention center because we wanted to get a pundit there to talk about this, not just Katha Pollitt in New York, to see sort of what was happening on the floor and the reaction there. But, well, we talked to a few people, but in the end, we thought Jimmy Cliff said it best.
I've got the battle won. I say forgive them, Lord. They know not what they've done. Sure as the sun will shine, I'm gonna get my share now. What's mine? And then the harder they come, the harder they fall. One and all. Ooh, the harder they come, harder they fall. One and all.
That's right. The harder they come, the harder they fall. Jimmy Cliff, you're listening to Democracy Now!
It's been 28 years since a relatively handful of political hippies and yippies defied the autocratic power of then-Mayor Richard Daley Sr. and attempted to march on the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. The resulting violent confrontation was picked up by the news media, and protesters who were well aware of the camera's significance chanted, "The whole world is watching." This week in Chicago, the protests have been decidedly tamer, and an older, grayer group of radicals who once called for trashing the streets of Chicago are now advocating a more staid political pursuit, like lobbying and registering to vote. But Pacifica's Paul DiRienzo, who has spent the week on the streets of Chicago, found some young firebrands who yearned for a return to the more confrontational style of politics, but with an agenda more in line with the 90s.
They're giving us the street. They're just going to wait for traffic control, all right? We took them by surprise. Okay.
The whole world was definitely not watching this demonstration, and Chicago police officers actually chuckled in a good-natured fashion as they tried with little success to control a march of several hundred activists protesting the so-called war on drugs. The demonstrators were leaving Grant Park, where they were part of a week of alternative activities billed as the Festival of Life, the same name used for an aborted rally in the same park in 1968. Despite the small turnout, the Cures Not Wars rally was lively, led by a float festooned with signs demanding legalization of medical marijuana, an end to the drug war, and calling for more research into an hallucinogenic African rainforest plant called Ibogaine that's been used to treat some drug addictions. As fighter jets from a convention-related air show roared overhead, the march made its way past a federal prison and through downtown Chicago. One of the speakers was Dave Dellinger, a veteran of 1968, and the conspiracy trial that followed a year later. As a member of the celebrated Chicago Seven, Dellinger talked about political prisoners of today and recounted the first time he smoked pot. It was with a man he had met in prison after an anti-war protest.
He came and joined our commune, and the first thing he did was to give me a marijuana cigarette. Of course I didn't inhale. So how come I felt so good?
Chicago police were surprisingly relaxed throughout the raucous march, allowing demonstrators into the street and giving organizers pretty much all they wanted. But the image of congeniality was breached when an anti-nuclear activist drove up to the fountain in Grant Park, towing a float with a mock-up of a nuclear waste cask.
And all of a sudden, all these cops come out of everywhere, and we had a little event. You know, we're not scheduled to be here till tomorrow, so I'm happy.
Mateo came to Chicago to protest plans to use Yucca Mountain in Nevada to permanently store waste from the nation's nuclear plants. Anti-nuclear activists are concerned about the safety of the site and the transportation of the radioactive waste on public roads. It turns out he was taking a rest at the precise spot where Vice President Al Gore was to make an unscheduled appearance at a Democratic Party outing. Within seconds, police and Secret Service agents appeared out of nowhere, and Mateo and his companions began to speak out to a growing crowd of protesters, forcing the cops back. He describes what the model is depicting.
The ones that will actually be used on the highways and on trains are quite a bit bigger than this, 3 or 4 times bigger. What it is the ends are the shock absorbers, supposedly. So if there is an accident, then they'll absorb the shock, supposedly. And then inside of here would be enough plutonium to match the radiation value of 200 Hiroshima bombs.
But even Mateo had to admit that President Clinton has said he's opposed to using Yucca Mountain as a nuclear waste site. Clinton's position on this and many other issues has often changed with the political winds, making it difficult for protesters at the Democratic Convention to unite and build any serious opposition to the Democratic Party agenda, something discovered by a former defendant in the Chicago 7 trial. Tom Hayden is now a Democratic California state senator, but as he tried to speak at the Festival of Life, he was quickly met by hecklers who drove him from the stage.
One out of six of them were undercover police. So let me get back to my point for those of you who want to hear it. No, you're probably too crazy to be an undercover police officer.
Yes, it's crazy to try and practice free speech in Chicago today.
The point is, don't blame anybody for somebody else's failure. If you invite somebody to speak, let them speak. My message is delivered. Good luck to you.
The heckling was led by Madison, Wisconsin activist Ben Mazel, who was arrested handing out leaflets telling Bill Clinton that he's no Thomas Jefferson. And despite the Chicago Police Department's good-natured face, demonstration organizers, including American Indian Movement founder Vernon Belcourt, bitterly complained of their treatment at the hands of Chicago Mayor Richard Daley Jr. Belcourt says the protests would have been a lot larger if...
The Festival for Life, the not on the guestless coalition that we are all part of, had not got jacked around by the city of Chicago. They only got the permit for this facility 2 days ago. being sabotaged by the city so that they could not build a massive gathering that would have been here.
But again, Belcourt says political prisoner Leonard Peltier has a better chance of getting a pardon from Clinton in his second term than if Dole is elected president. Inside the convention hall, located several miles from Grant Park, the talk has been about the ascendancy of Democratic Party moderates and conservatives and the distancing of the party's more liberal wing, represented by many of the demonstrators. But California Representative Maxine Waters, who visited some of the protesters on Monday, says it's not the Democratic Party that's turned its back on progressives, but the media. And Waters adds, change will come when the left once again seizes the media spotlight to get their message out.
I don't think that the progressive voice has been muted at this convention. The progressive voice has been muted in America. What you find is the airwaves have been overtaken by the right-wingers and the religious right, and not enough has been done either by the Democratic Party or progressives to take their rightful place in the debate and create their own forums and access the media in ways that we have a voice.
No, down on the sidewalk. Otherwise, you are subject to arrest. You're trespassing. Let's go.
On a park?
Yes.
Racist, sexist, anti-gay, born-again bigots, go away!
Protesters from a group calling themselves Refuse and Resist at an event sponsored by the Anti-Abortion Christian Coalition at a Chicago museum. A new generation of young activists seems in the making as the pro-choicers, many just teenagers, confront the staid, upper-middle-class, middle-aged anti-choicers. This convention hasn't seen the political earthquakes of the past, but the fault lines are clearly there, waiting for the right issues to kindle the fires next time. For Pacifica Radio, I'm Paul DiRienzo in Chicago.
And thank you very much for that report, Paul. When we come back, we're going to be talking to some of the activists out in the streets of Chicago this week. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Salim Wakil. We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Salim Wakil, and we're joined in the studio by a room full of people, well, who weren't on the guest list this week at the Democratic National Convention. In fact, that was the name of their march on Wednesday, not on the guest list, when they got arrested. We're joined by Dave Dellinger, a familiar name, I'm sure, to many, here in 68, back again in 96. We're also joined by Andrew Hoffman, who runs America's Soup Kitchen up in Boston, also knows someone well who is here in 68. He's the son of Abby Hoffman. And we're joined by Barbara Peterson and Steve Sato, who are part of the group of protesters who were arrested this week. I want to welcome you all to Democracy Now! Dave Dellinger.
Good morning.
Why'd you come back?
Well, I came back just for one example, but there are many other examples. Leonard Peltier has gotten two life sentences for a crime that he did not commit. And even the prosecutor now says, we have no idea who killed those FBI agents. And the FBI has now admitted that it withheld evidence from the trial that would have proved his innocence. And even the Canadian government that was lied to and extradited him from Canada for the trial is very indignant about it. And, President Clinton knows that Leonard Peltier is innocent, and he doesn't have the political guts to free a man with two life sentences who's already done more than 20 years in prison.
There is a plea for clemency before him now, isn't there, as it has been for quite a long time now?
Yes, and actually the appeals court asked the Justice Department to analyze the case and make a report on it. And when I got together, people like Pete Seeger and Dick Gregory and actually Arun Gandhi, the grandson of Gandhi, and Grace Paley, the author, and Buffy St. Marie, and I got 15 of them who said, wanted to have a conference in the White House to talk about clemency. And when we asked for this, we got a letter back from the White House saying, we will not talk to anybody about Leonard Peltier until the Justice Department gives its report. And at that time, it was already more than 2 years. Now it's months later. And that's why and on March 20th, like I was arrested then for blocking the Justice Department door, but there were hundreds of people who did that, and in the end, when we were going to be arrested, a few of them moved to the side. But 26 of us were arrested there, and there were similar demonstrations in Minneapolis and Los Angeles. And we said at that point, if this does not free Leonard Peltier, then we're going to carry that message to the convention. Yeah. But when we were arrested at the Justice Department, one of the papers had a headline, Chicago police refused to arrest the demonstrators, so they had to go. So they went to the Justice Department to get what they implied was an artificial arrest.
Now, for listeners who actually weren't even born when Leonard Peltier was imprisoned, he was put in jail 2 decades ago. Is that right?
He has been in, yes.
And he's currently in Fort Leavenworth?
In February, we had a demonstration, was at the end of the second decade, yes. When he came up for a parole hearing, was forced by the pressures that people like us here and others all over the world had done, the hearing officer recommended parole. Mm-hmm. And so when they denied the parole, they fired the hearing officer and said that he had overstepped his bounds.
Dave Dellinger, I can't help but be struck by the passion in your voice and the fact that you're still very much involved in this in the protest of these injustices. Andrew Hoffman, why do you think that there's not similar kinds of passions being expressed among younger people?
I think that there are, and I think that younger people are also just biding their time and taking care of business and waiting for a moment when they will rise up and take their rightful place as the owners of this planet and our society. And I think that they're not going to deal with this monopoly money economy that we have, and they're going to revert to a social justice economy and an economy of ecology.
Where do you see signs of this?
I see little signs of it all over the place. I'm involved on the streets doing America's Soup Kitchen on Wheels, which is involved with building a movement from the streets up, and that's the way my father taught me that any good, solid movement has to be built. And I'm out there talking to the people and relating to younger people every day. And I am very optimistic about the future.
Barbara Peterson, do you feel like your voice, along with Dave Dellinger's and Andrew Hoffman's, were heard this week? I mean, at the Democratic Convention, where we were spending a lot of time, you guys were far away.
Well, we weren't there to necessarily upstage the Democratic Convention or to play into the press's desire to sort of put us away quietly. We were there just to get our message out. We've been doing this prior to Chicago in Washington, D.C. I was in Washington, D.C. at that time. We'll be doing it after Chicago. So this was one stop along the way of a very long train I'd like to add just briefly to what Andrew said also. Please remember that the American youth have been so victimized by our government that they are fighting for their financial survival. AIDS is out there taking our youth away. They're fighting for their lives on a day-to-day basis. It is hard to organize and come together and fight globally or nationally when you're looking for your next meal or where your health care is going to come from.
Steve Sato, did you spend much time in the protest pen? I mean, we should lay out for the listeners exactly what the scene was. It was incredible.
We didn't go to the pen.
Well, it was actually worse than the Republican convention. The Republican convention was two railroad tracks away. You had to jump over wire fences and two sets of railroad tracks with trolleys on them to get to the Republican convention, and the voices could hardly be heard. But here, it was even farther away. I just wanted to comment, interestingly, here across the street from the Democratic convention was Malcolm X College. And in San Diego at the Republican convention, you not only had to jump over two railroad tracks and at least two fences, but you had to cross Martin Luther Way Jr. Mm-hmm. Martin Luther King Jr. Way.
My impression, well, first of all, regarding the protest pit, right from the beginning, we weren't going to go along with that. And once we were there, actually, we had to go actually into the convention center to do a couple of CNN shows. And there was a lot of confusion when we got to where we were supposed or tried to get to where we were supposed to be picked up, to be taken to the show. And there was mass confusion. We finally got in at times. And so we were at an intersection where one of the protest pits was at. And my impression, there was nobody at the protest pits. There were small groups with nobody there listening to them.
Except the police
standing around, just basically blocking these blocked intersections.
Not only that, I mean, talking about control, the Democratic National Committee, I assume it was them, in the protest pen, they controlled the sound system. And it was a very good sound system, I should say, better than anything I've heard, very clear, but at the end of each hour, because a protest group could only be there for an hour, chosen by lottery, they would turn off the mic system, and then they would usher people out and usher people in. And they got very nervous. I saw a protest against U.S. aid to Israel when a group of Muslims started to pray and brought the mic off of the stage, God forbid.
Yeah. Well, like I said, when the whole thing came up with Mayor Daley's lottery system to, like, basically get win, you know, like a raffle to get spots in the protest pit, right away our reaction, not on the Guest List Coalition and other groups, we just weren't going to go along with the program. My impression, again, another impression was that, you know, this was a way by the city, Mayor Daley, his people, whoever, to basically diffuse and dilute any sort of gathering.
Back in February, I applied for a permit through my nonprofit, America's Soup Kitchen on Wheels, for Grant Park for the Festival of Life Continues. And I was trying to reach out to the Daley administration to set up a structure which I felt would be beneficial and would allow us to all come together as protesters and build a larger coalition. And I think that it was very underhanded and very evil of Daley to not only sidetrack us continuously and not give us a permit until 1 week before we were ready to go.
Maybe when you applied, when you wrote down your name, you should have said you were son of Julius rather than son of Abbott.
You know, I also want to point out that the police, the city is getting a lot of praise for at least not beating us up massively. But on the other hand, when we leave here, we're going to the arraignment of one of the people who was arrested with us. And he is, because he's a local activist who they want to destroy, you know, he was arrested for mob action.
Which is totally
during
absurd.
During a Tuesday march and activity when I was by his side all the way. And there was no way that he either did or the kind of person he being, Reverend Ron Shuck, that he would have thrown a bottle and hit a cop, which is what apparently they're claiming. And so it's just terribly important that we support those people, and we are yes. going there. And if necessary, I may even cancel my trip home tomorrow in order to
There are other brothers and sisters of ours who are in jail now on the same trumped-up charge. The Chicago police made a sweep. At least 24 people are in jail on various charges. We are not even sure how many on that federal charge, which is a serious charge and completely erroneous. And we are in support of them. Reverend Ron is a member of the Board of Directors of America's Soup Kitchen on Wheels. He's been working in this community for many years. And it is obvious that they did this.
They targeted him.
They targeted him and others. And
whereas if they targeted Andrew and me, they wouldn't have gotten away with it.
Right.
And we're determined that they won't get away with this.
Dave Dellinger, how old are you now, if you don't mind my asking?
I'm so old I can't remember, but I think I'm 81.
What is your sense of activism today compared to what it was when you came here in your 50s in 1968?
Well, I think that more people understand today than in the 60s. That the system simply will not work. And I often make the comparison that I cut my political teeth during the Great Depression. And then everybody wanted to revamp the system so that it, you know, modify it so that it would work. And they did a few good things. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, people are so discouraged they don't even vote anymore. And I support those who refuse to vote because the multinational corporations, without their support, without being captured by them, it's impossible to get elected to big national office. The multinational corporations today have made the U.S. government obsolete. The multinational rich billionaire corporations are actually running the world. And I have found I speak in more high schools today than I did during the early 60s. Mm-hmm. And I found that everywhere I go, people understand that the change, social change, begins in their own lives, and they are organizing, and Andrew is a good example of that. They're organizing their own communities. They're working together to help the poor, the homeless, the oppressed for racial reasons and all the rest. And
so, you know, speaking of...
So I am very optimistic that this is all going to come together. So that things have gotten worse in as far as society, with 1% of the population controlling, owning more wealth than the bottom 96%.
And that gap is growing even wider as we speak.
Yes. Without economic democracy, there can be no political democracy.
Exactly. The campaign to cast a check, which was another protest attempt, one of the things that was striking about that was the lack of interest in it. And it had all of the heavy hitters there. It was Jesse Jackson, Reverend Al Sharpton, Conrad Worrell, who's a big organizer in this area. But they couldn't.
I think a lot of that has to do with the stigma of 68, which is still hanging over our heads. People are desperate out there, and they're just not willing to put their bodies on the line, and they were afraid. They were afraid that the police would do what they did last night, conveniently while the president was here, while all of the news media was occupied. They swept the city, and they dragged people out of buildings, and they maced a few people. And it's outrageous, and we're not going to let them get away with it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming into our studios and coming to Chicago. Andrew Hoffman, Dave Dellinger, Barbara Peterson, and Steve Sato. You've been listening to Democracy Now!, produced by Julie Drizin. Our engineer, Don Mueller, at the studios of WFMT here in Chicago. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. 0230. With Salim Muakil, I'm Amy Goodman for Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Good morning. From Chicago, this is Democracy Now! The Democratic National Convention is over, and it's time to go home. But before we do, a living legend joins us for a look back at political conventions past and present, a conversation with Studs Terkel. And poetry from the protest pen.
The parades, masquerades, the politicians, Christians, all around do-gooders, flash their smiles plus miles of sympathy. A symphony of applauded promises for the unwanted, the unriched, the systematically oppressed, the educationally repressed. The city.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And welcome to our last second hour of Democracy Now! From Chicago, covering the Democratic National Convention from the inside and the outside. I'm Amy Goodman with Salim Wakil, senior editor at In These Times, based here in Chicago, and also a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times. Coming up in a little while, you're going to be hearing some of the sounds from outside. Yes, the sounds from the protest pen. Poets speaking to the delegates, but speaking to each other. And interestingly enough, the largest audience there was the police that surrounded them. But right now...
Right now, we're privileged to have in our studios a man who virtually embodies Chicago, a living legend, author of 9 books, including one that has my story in it.
Here it is.
Studs Terkel. Studs, thank you for joining us. We are
thank
absolutely
you.
Privileged.
I like your style, Salim.
thank you, Studs. Studs, since we're talking about the conventions and whatnot, you've seen quite a few of these conventions mm-hmm. come and go. And in Chicago, which is mm-hmm. the convention city, you've seen mm-hmm. them. What are some of your immediate impressions?
Well, this one is as bland and programmed as much as the one in San Diego was. The difference is one slightly of substance, because the supporters of Clinton are somewhat different than the supporters of Dole. However, we're talking about two empty vessels, really, aren't we? The real difference between Clinton and Dole can be poured into Tom Thumb's thimble. And you still have a little space for a small martini. But basically, there is a slight difference. The supporters, of course, are those we know, and a lot of them we admire, and some just hacks. But the fact is there are some differences. So the question is, the usual question, we'll come to the conventions, do you vote for the lesser of the two evils? Michael Moore, in the current edition of The Nation, speaks of the evil of the two lessers, you know. Mm-hmm. And then there's a question long ago offered, the challenge and the question. I would rather vote for something I want and not get it than vote for something I don't want and get it. And how often will we go along with the lesser of the two
that's
evils?
That's all we've been able to do thus far. And speaking of what we voted for and got, we've gotten Clinton, and we also got Dick Morris, who was...
Well, now you raise an interesting... Here they say it's a scandal. What is so scandalous about one whore visiting another? Now, think about it now. I mean, I know it's a harsh phrase, but he is for hire. He works for a troglodyte like Jesse Helms and other such, and without blinking an eye works for seemingly enlightened Clinton. And he's the one whose advice Clinton took when he signed the death warrant, maybe for I don't know how many poor kids. He tore away in what is called the welfare deform bill or whatever mm-hmm. it is, and he tore away the safety net for the most vulnerable of our species, poor kids, that's been there ever since I'm old enough to remember the second inaugural address of Franklin D. Roosevelt when it began. I see one-third of a nation ill-fed, ill-clothed, ill-housed. And then came the WPA government, big government.
This is the beginning of the big government.
Big government stepped in, and there was the WPA, Harry Hatton Jobs provider, the PWA of Harold Ickes, I suppose the grandfather, the advisor, who was ignored. The resettlement administration, which poor farmers and sharecroppers got a chunk of land under Rex Stugwell, all were attacked at the time. But that became the safety net for the most vulnerable. And that's removed by a Democratic president. And at the advice of
Dick Morris. And now he comes, so we have a case of someone who is, you might say, a high-priced, upscale call boy visiting a more modestly priced call girl. What it mostly provides for us is what? It's a metaphor, a dreary metaphor for our whorish times. Let's face the reality, the harsh reality of it. And that's what it's about. So that's no scandal. The scandal is, of course, the measure that Clinton signed.
It couldn't have been put more appropriately. A metaphor for these whorish times, indeed. Yeah. Do you see any chance that we'll be emerging from these horrid
times?
Well,
I suppose the other day I ran into, by accident, Wellstone, Senator Wellstone. Wellstone, Paul Wellstone of Minnesota, the one senator with guts up for re-election who voted against it. He feels fairly hopeful. The implications are that Clinton will win and that there's this whole group, the Black Caucus, those like him, will now put his feet to the fire. And so he feels sort of hopeful in that sense. And I hope he's right, and I admire him very much.
You know, Studs, I was saying to all those Democratic Congress members and delegates who continually repeated that refrain, so I think it was put out from the administration, we have to reelect President Clinton because he did sign this welfare repeal bill. And I'd say, wait, what are you saying? Because you're against it? And they would say, because if we reelect him and if we have a Democratic Congress, he can change some aspects of the law. I say, what if he's not reelected? What is the legacy he leaves this country?
But for the moment, just assume reelection and come to your other question, what if he's not? He'll reform it. It's like someone signing a death warrant. Whoever it is dead. And the guy says, look, don't worry, I'll revive him. In a sense, it amounts to that. Now your other question. So Salim, ask Salim, and then I'll try to think about it.
Well, the whole idea that they're saying, they're sort of holding the population hostage, saying, okay, we signed this. If you put us back in, we will change it. Well, what if the voters don't put him back in? Then he leaves with his administration as having removed 60 years of federal assistance for the poor in this country. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and I do want to say it's a great privilege to have you in our actually in your studio, Studs, because we're reporting here. We're in Chicago just visiting, although Salim lives here, after especially your, you went through, what was it, a quintuple?
It was a medical adventure, and I've lost about 20 pounds, so I'm in the fighting weight, 135. I can take on all comers, lightweight division.
You really look good. You look revitalized.
Lightweight division, I fight Battling Nelson. He won the lightweight title in 1908, and I'll meet him just as he is today.
A lot of people tried to compare the Chicago of 68 to the Chicago of 96. What differences do you see between the two dailies, the father and son?
Well, the times have changed. The city has changed. Remember when the elder daily was there, he had far more clout than a son is because he held a people, the African-American people, hostage because they had an overseer.
Dawson.
His name was Bill Dawson. Dawson was the most powerful black man in America. He controlled the plantation, as it was, really. Now, the plantation days are over. There's a great deal of bewilderment now in the black community. There is everywhere, and there's one or another pushing around one way or another, trying to some support. Under Harold Washington, of course, it was a marvelous moment. Best mayor Chicago ever had. And he was a mayor, by the way, who, can you imagine a Chicago mayor who read books? And he did all the time. But coming back to Chicago then and now, it's altered. He's considerably different. There are certain amenities he does observe that the old man didn't, certain civil, that he has to. So in that sense, it's different because no longer is the plantation here. The machine creaks along on its own way, and of course he has his own sort of clout. But in a general sense, whether he helps the city, to some extent. But the difference is one of the city, the time, rather than the person.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to go back even before Richard Daley Sr. You were just mentioning FDR's second term and when he made that speech, when he instituted welfare as we know it in this country, or I should say as we knew it. Let's go back to that time and talk a little more about it.
But here, let's not glorify FDR either. He was, well, my favorite president, of course, by far the best of our century, by far. However, it was bottom-up pressures. There was a Great Depression. There are all sorts of grassroots things happening on the streets. You know how Social Security came into being? He wasn't for it himself. He didn't. Remember, this first term was a budget balancing term, meant nothing. The second term, there was so much pressure from below. The various groups were there. And the CIO, of course, is being formed. But a guy, I guess you call him an agitator, was fighting for something radical, something subversive called Social Security. And I forget this guy's name. He wanted to get attention. So like the kids of 68, you know what he did? It was a big ballroom. He hopped onto a chandelier. And he swung on the chandelier back and forth. It was a scandal. But he brought attention to what he was for, Social Security. Not too different from the kids seeking attention about the war and civil rights and all else in 68. So Roosevelt was answering. Remember, also, when the Fair Employment Practices Act was passed, he wasn't for it because he was thinking about the South and the vote. But A. Philip Randolph had planned a march on Washington and others, and so there's a tremendous... And how are you going to stop that march? So finally, this bill, I forget the number, was passed. So that's one of the bases, Amy and Salim, the basis of what happened during those 30s. It was always a deep movement in the South.
We're talking, of course, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with this mellifluous, elegant voice of Studs Terkel. See, now you don't have to go to physical therapy this morning. We'll do the therapy for them.
We'll butter you up enough.
You know, I wanted to go to look at a comparison between President Clinton and Richard Nixon. Would you say it's fair to say that on domestic policy, in fact, Richard Nixon was actually to the left of Bill Clinton?
Well, there again, it was Nixon, not Nixon the angel, but Nixon the practical politician, replying or trying to reply to meet the challenges that came about at that moment. There was a good number of bottom-up stuff. See, what's happened, I suppose, it's a challenge to people who may be listening, who are parts of various movements, peace or environmental or green movement, whatever it might be. There's been a disparity. There's been a breakdown in some. But these are going on. I think they're individual enclaves, little ones. But there's been no coalescence. And which leads us to the big question. Since when are there only two parties as something testament or written in stone? And if ever there were a time for a new party, and perhaps the word new party itself can be capitalized, ever there were a time for a third party, who decided that the two parties? We know the contributors are the same pretty much. Republicans get more dough from the big boys than the Democrats do. But they both get, it's pretty much in the seven figures around.
No question about that. More than seven figures.
More
and if
seven.
You look at this convention, I think just the Democratic convention, they got about $40 million, about $12 million from the federal government. The rest, those corporations.
I'm thinking about contributions, of course. And so when in the world are we going to have an alternative, a third party?
Well,
which is a big question.
We really asked that question in 1984 and 88 when Jesse Jackson ran, and he kind of stoked the embers of desire for such a third party. And Jesse made a statement similar to what you made trying to justify support for Clinton, that Clinton is not the progressive politician that we want, but pressure from the bottom will make him that progressive politician.
We do know he's quite pliable, to put it mildly.
Indeed.
He's
so
putty.
What do you think? What do you think about Jesse Jackson's role?
That's an interesting one. I don't know. I'm fond of Jesse Jackson. The once upon a time had a public conflict with him way back about, and I realized that I shouldn't have done it. I think he was wrong. It's a long story. But I shouldn't have done it because I mean, I got calls from every phony in the book saying, Stud, you're great, you're on our side. And then I knew I did something wrong. But Jesse, I think, has grown. I think he has developed from the time when he reputedly had the bloody shirt when Dr. King died. I think he's grown tremendously since. And Marshall Frady's biography, I find, a very good one on Jesse. You think of a guy, he's the only guy could ever get the hostages back home, the only one. And yet, what's the first question they ask at a greeting? They ask, where'd you get the money? Who backed you? See? But in a way, I think he's trying to play the political game. He thinks to survive or to have his thoughts survive. And so he made the speech, not in prime time, nor for that matter, Cuomo, because remember the announcers, here's the, you might have to take off on it just for a minute, the perversion of the American language. Aside from the horrid times we live in, the language has been perverted. So they were kept off prime time, he and Cuomo, because they were liberals. The L word. So the L word has replaced the C word of the 50s. So liberal has now become that. And so the language itself has become very perverted.
Indeed. What is liberal?
And so that's part of the
interface. So that's one of the things we talked about throughout the week, this whole issue of prime time, the network saying we're going to give 1 hour to the convention. I don't care, you know, how much time they give to the convention each night. Maybe even that's too much. But I think the outrage of it is they say to the Democrats, we're going to give you this time, 9 to 10. And basically they have the Democrats producing their show, because instead of using that hour to say we're going to take Jesse Jackson from 2 hours ago and we're going to take a bit of Cuomo, they will run what is running then. And so the Democrats decide what message they want to put out and who they want to put it out. Also, Ted Kennedy wasn't in prime time.
Yeah, not unlike, by the way, the Republican convention as well, both.
Absolutely.
Not unlike the Gulf War coverage. The generals said, we'll tell you, and the reporters, with the exception, of course, of we know who sued, Nation and some of the other alternative in these times magazine, but the established press went right along. Just the analogy is stunning. There was the war, and here's the and the same, and the reporters just were supine, or the publishers.
And you know, not only did we sue for restrictions around the Persian Gulf War, us group of independent media outlets, but the major media wouldn't cover the suit because they weren't involved.
Of course, I know before I came on. You and Salim had as guests Dave Dellinger and some of the younger. Wrote, of course, they were blocked out and was ridiculed, naturally. Mm-hmm. The way to do it, much more effective this way than the way Daly the Elder did it then, you see, much more effective. This time was just blacking them out. Easy, smiling, blacking them out.
Studs, you were talking about the perversion of the language. Another aspect of that, I think, is how the radical right, the militia right, has appropriated much of the language of the left in a very...
Well, think of the word life, pro-life, as though people for choice are pro-death, you see. Pro-life, you see. They don't ask of the life of someone, maybe the life of the fetus, but not of the life of that same fetus, 18-year-old kid going to war. Not too worried about life then.
That's right. You see?
But coming back to this matter of the language taken.
Right. And Pat Buchanan seemed to have struck a chord among those people. What do you think about
Pat Buchanan struck a chord. He came out against NAFTA. Remember that? He spoke of the peasant rebellion. We know he was a demagogue. We know he was a bigot. But the fact is he was able... Maybe populist through the years have become. George Wallace was a populist to a great extent, calling upon blue-collar people working. And so Buchanan touched real chords. Of course he did.
Well, it would seem like that would be a hint to the Democrats or some other party to strike similar chords to evoke the same kind of response.
Of course. But what have we got? We have something called flaccidity.
Flaccidity. Let me write that down. Look it up.
Flaccidity. There's nothing. No muscle, no nothing. It's... Oh, God, a viscous sort of like that.
Studs, I don't know if this follows from flaccidity, but I wanted to ask you about American labor and about what is being described as a resurgence. You have Union Summer, the summer with thousands of kids around the country.
Yeah.
You've got the unions, the AFL-CIO, pouring $35 million into campaigns to basically defeat the Republicans and bring the Democrats into control. What do you think of the alliance of the labor with the Democratic Party?
Well, it's not fully. I mean, it's not so much. I'm interested more in the resurgence of the labor movement. And remember, there are new constituents now, members. There are minority groups, women, Asian people to a great extent, as well as black people and Hispanic people, especially in the service employees' unions. And now, once upon a time, the union were run by hoods and thugs. So what I'm really worried about is the Teamster election at this moment, which is a key one. Ron Carey, for the first time, had a rank-and-file vote. And now the papers, the press, here again we come to the joke, the grotesque joke, liberal media. If ever there were the most grotesque joke. And so that the press are playing up Jimmy Hoffa as a hero. In Chicago, there's a guy named, an old hack named Hogan, the ally of Hoffa, anti the rank and file vote, who's played up in the papers and the columns. So he even said the film guy in town. They pay tribute. See, it's this aspect again of the press and its... it's, well, what's the word? Whatever the word
I think
is.
Whorish.
Whorish is the word. Press check. See, Upton Sinclair wrote a book about the press, the whorishness of the press, went back in 1950, called The Brass Check, because the brass check, when a guy went to visit a sporting house, house of ill fame, whorehouse, he'd pay $2, and the madam would give him a brass check, which she gave to the girl. At the end, she would cash in her brass checks and get a buck for each one to say. So The Brass Check was his book about journalism.
Studs, we have to break for 1 minute, and then we'll be back. Yes, we'll be back with Studs Terkel. I'm Amy Goodman with Salim Wakil here in Chicago. You're listening to Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now! But Studs, in answer to your question, how is this going? It's going well. And it's going particularly well because you're here with us. Again, for our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman with Salim Wakil. And, you know, Stud said he's here because of Salim. And he knows Salim from this radio station, WFMT. And what? I should reveal a secret. We came to Chicago not for the Democratic National Convention, but just to spend some time with Salim, because we're always doing it by phone. It's nice to spend time.
Salim Wakil, by the way, I think is one of the most perceptive commentators. Not simply the subject of race, but connecting it with all other aspects. So interesting that the Sun Times wants him, but he still wants to stick within these times.
Oh. Woo. Can't ask for a better testimony than that. Speaking of writing and whatnot, what books do you have planned coming?
Well,
out?
The one, you know, I suppose, I won't say the last one, but the one is a sort of compendium of starting with Division Street to the last one, but not in that order. Sort of my century. I call it my American century since I was born. When the Titanic went down, I came up, you know. But then as Jimmy Carter said, who said life is fair? You know, and that was 1912. And I said to the surgeon, I want 4 more years up to, he said, I'll give you 10. I said, I want 4, never mind the 21st century. I don't have any bridges to it either. It's just, I'm thinking about technology's effect on us all. But they're coming back. So this book is a compilation of all the introductions plus 5 or 6 portraits from each of the ones, ending up with age.
Well, speaking of age, and you talking to your surgeon that you want 4 more years, has the operation you've gone through changed your view of things?
No, except that made me feel, I guess more, I shouldn't say this, darkly amused by things. As you get older, this is a Samuel Beckett approach gets in there, you know. And so, no, it hasn't changed. It was very funny because the two surgeons, there were two. One was the heart, and that was 7 hours. And then 3 days later, they find out my intestines are almost gangrenous. And so there was 4 hours more. So it's my heart and the belly. And both those surgeons, you know, surgeons are the prima donnas of the hospital. I thought of one as Olivier, the other as Brando, you know. And so, but they were skilled. I shouldn't be kidding them because they saved my life. But in any event, no, it hasn't changed my view any, other than a little more impatient, I suppose, with what I consider hypocrisy, you know, and the perversion of the American language to some extent.
Well, I'm very glad you're sitting here with us. you're certainly a star, but it makes me think, and I hope you're not horrified by this, of other stars, and that's the stars that they brought out, a different kind of stars at the Democratic Convention. I mean, it was really shameless. This was completely produced for TV. It was produced by a Hollywood producer. And throughout the Democratic Convention, they had video moments, well-produced pieces, you know, aimed for television. And they had stars throughout the week. You had Jennifer Holliday, the singer. Emmylou Harris sang. Edward James Olmos. You had the cast of Rent, the Broadway production, performing.
You're naming the better ones. That's the interesting thing. See, there were a slew of others, not nearly. The point is, of course they owned TV. And they were on for hours with this trivia and shameless sort of, almost quite vulgar stuff, as a matter of fact. But strangely enough, Nightline had Haskell Wexler on. Has the marvelous, very courageous cinematographer who did Medium Cool. And that was on, Nightline was on about a quarter to 12. Now, Haskell Wexler was on talking, demonstrating the 60s. And it was a marvelous program, I thought. And that was on a quarter to 12. Until then, it was an hour and a half of the stuff you describe, which tells you what they think of.
Yeah, it's all scripted, and it appears that this may be the last of these kind of conventions, because I don't think that the American people can actually tolerate this kind of hypocrisy much longer.
To think, you know, it'd just be autobiographical. I was 12 years old, 1924, and it was a summer resort, and I wouldn't leave the Atwater Kent radio because I was taken with the voices of the Democratic Convention in New York. 102 ballots it went for 10 days. And I was glued to it because, you knew, and I heard the same voice, the Alabama first voice, 24 votes for Underwood. That was the favorite son. And I went on, and there was a deadlock between Al Smith and William Gibbs McAdoo, Wilson's son-in-law, and they chose a Wall Street lawyer, Davis, who was clobbered by Calvin Coolidge. By this time, my brother got me onto, I became a third-party groupie. And by that time, Bob La Follette ran for president here. And so I thought of Bob La Follette. And so it was a reunion of University of Chicago law graduates, about 25, 1960, 50, 60 election, and votes for president. And so my sleek fellow alumni, the vote was about 54 for Nixon, 52 for Kennedy, and one for Bob La Follette. And they all looked at me and said, oh, him.
Old habits die hard. Huh?
Yeah.
Studs, before you go, how did you end up doing what you were doing?
Accidental, an accretion of accidents. I went to law school, God forgive me. It's not their fault, it's mine.
When?
In Chicago. I went to the Chicago Law School through in 1934. I dreamed of Clarence Darrow and woke up to Julius Hoffman. And so then that's it. No contract, it wasn't for me. So I became an actor in radio soap operas. I was a gangster, I was getting killed, a disc jockey, even a sportscaster for a while. And finally, WFMT and a TV program, part of Chicago-style TV. So one thing led to another, and my publisher, Andre Schifrin, once heard some of my interviews, and he liked them, and so the rest, as we say,
it's Pantheon, history. Used to, later Pantheon Press, right?
Pantheon, now New Press.
Would, yeah. Okay.
Compare radio to TV.
Well, I like radio much better, of course. Radio, as we're talking now, you're free. We have an engineer, Don. But that's about it. And on TV, you're subject to every aspect, as well as, of course, you're not subject to the, because your sponsors are not, as far as I understand, Amoco or General Electric, you know. And so, therefore, this is very free, of course. You couldn't possibly do this on. But not only the substance, the very nature of it makes you more of an automaton. Or, you know, who are the commentators? They're readers of notes, and they know how to censor themselves. That's the big thing. We have no heavy hand of government censoring us. There'd be a samizdat if there were. You see, we don't have that. We have something far deeper: self-censorship, knowing what to ask, what not to ask, and so you have no attack on General Electric and NBC since they own it, right? So, of course, that's it throughout. So radio, I love radio because the imagination, the voice, you can sing and you can bring in music. And in fact, you at the microphone are in charge.
You know, speaking of being in charge, it makes me think of not being in charge. And that is the Democratic and Republican convention. Those that were in charge were the corporations. And interestingly enough, in San Diego, one of the many parties that were held celebrating one of the delegations was Time Warner's party. And you know that Time Warner would not allow the press in?
Shades of Gulf War all over again.
Well, we want to thank you very much for joining us, Studs. I hate to kick you out of the studio, but I know you have to go to your therapy appointment, and that's very important to me.
And viva Pacifica.
Viva. Viva Studs Terkel.
Studs Terkel on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with a discussion about what's happened this week and what's coming up, and then poetry from the protest pen here in Chicago.
Can't you smell the milk of human kindness souring on the porch? While you sit here broke and stroke your family values. Used to stand for something, now you sit for everything. Circling like a dove with no left wing. Now the lights are out, the heat is gone, you're living by the torch. Always thumbing through the cue cards Bill and Al use. Had to hog the children and put your mom and dad in storage while you gorge on the latest George. And you're leaving today,
leaving today,
going to Chicago on a mission for the middleman. Tilting toward the wilting flowers in the vase. And the two cats in the yard have got their claws out.
Everything was easy in our very, 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 very fine house.
Fine house.
But the fire is doused, and now you're playing Faust.
And I don't mean the Randy Newman record.
The Foreman singing Chicago. Love song to the Democrats here on Democracy Now! And I'm Amy Goodman with Salim. And we have a few minutes just to talk before we move on to that poetry from the protest pen, which was an amazing moment just in the last few nights of the Democratic Convention and that empty place where only police surrounded it. And this group of poets came to let people know or let themselves know or let the police know how they felt in some beautiful prose. So we're going to be going to that soon. But Salim, before we do that, just a chance to hang out
well,
and talk about this week.
That pen, that protest pen is perhaps the best metaphor for what happened this week. Everything, all of the dissent was constrained and contained and sanitized. And even the dissent that attempted to transverse the boundaries was weak and ineffectual. It was really the triumph of consensus politics and really boogeyman politics. I mean, evoking the name of Gingrich as this terrible alternative just forged a unity that was unshakable, unbreakable.
I mean, I had to say, the fact that there was no protest on the convention floor by delegates, who a number of them absolutely outraged, I mean, truly outraged, not just saying it, about welfare repeal or, as Stud said, welfare deform. And yet, in the end, Donna Shalala and Henry Cisneros, people who were opposed to welfare repeal bill, but now were sent out by the administration to be the best ones to convince the Democrats not to rise up. There, these people were from local union leaders. I know from the delegation in New York talking to them, tremendous anger. And yet they sat there. And there were a lot of choices. They could have protested on the convention floor. They could have gone outside, still been delegates, and protested with the people outside. Or they could have torn up their delegate credentials. Bobby Rush, the former Black Panther and now Chicago Congress member, said he was going to rip them up. But then he said he decided not to, that they could work on the bill. And I said, well, then why didn't you remain a delegate but actually protest on the floor? But Clinton was very afraid of that protest, and I think that could be a big problem for him now because, as a result, there was no story. And when the Dick Morris flap came out yesterday, that was the story everyone was reporting on all day, all the networks. Now, some might say, this guy's an, you know, just a staff person. You're not electing a president. Yeah, staff person. You're electing a president. But Dick Morris really is a symbol of all that President Clinton is, because President Clinton is following his lead on tax cuts, on welfare repeal, et cetera.
And on welfare repeal. I mean, and Clinton is comfortably ahead in the polls. Most pundits think that this welfare, signing this welfare bill was really unnecessary. But yet at the urging of Dick Morris, he pushed that particular aspect of it, and also at the urging of Dick Morris, this kind of consensus Democratic facade is also his doing, and again maybe his undoing, because there was no controversy, and as you pointed out, the press went straight for the Dick Morris story.
You know, I went on the floor with Michael Moore, who's just written Downsize This and produced Roger and Me, the story of him chasing after Roger Smith, who is the head of GM. And he was amazed, first of all, being legitimately on the floor, but talking about the fact that 120 million people in this country don't vote. Now, this is an amazing figure. I knew that the figures are very high. You know that President Clinton got elected by just about a quarter of the vote in this country. Mm-hmm. A quarter. Imagine if that was the case in a country that the United States government didn't like, what they would make of that.
Absolutely.
But 120 million people didn't vote. That is equivalent to the voting age population of 42 states, not including the 8 largest states. That's the number of people that do not vote. And the Democrats and the Republicans who are in power benefit from this.
They like it that way. They like it that way. Incidentally, let me mention that Jesse Jackson, who was a team player in the convention, did, in fact, join the protest. He was part of this protest, the campaign to cash the check, which I was quite surprised to see him there. In fact, he was enthusiastically supporting it. So there is one exception, but you may look at that exception again as Jesse kind of playing both sides.
Did inside the convention. I mean, here you had his performance inside the convention, not in primetime, in the beginning, a very powerful speech. He wasn't reading it from the teleprompter, which was the first time I didn't see someone reading from the teleprompter. He had it in his hands. But what did that mean? Because in the end, he came out more strongly for Clinton than he had for any Democratic presidential candidate in all the time he's been active. He was actually chanting 4 more years.
He was indeed. And again, it's the specter of Gingrich, the Gingrich-Dole combo that strikes fear in the hearts of folks like Jesse.
And it also may be a lot of corporate money that's floating around that's going to a lot of candidates and delegates that are keeping them in line. And when push comes to shove, the Clinton administration can go after people like Bobby Rush and say, we're going to cut off the purse strings.
When push comes to shove, and it often comes to shove.
Well, you know, in last night's speech, what I was most impressed by was how much President Clinton was dealing with welfare. And yet, welfare is what? Less than 1% of the budget. What takes up more than 50% of the budget is the military. He did address it, but just once.
We are developing a sensible national missile defense, but we must not. Not now, not by the year 2000, squander $60 billion on an unproved, ineffective Star Wars program that could be obsolete tomorrow.
Now, this is a little argument that the Democrats are having with the Republicans, and I was just thinking of Studs saying the difference between them can fit into a thimble with a little, martini in there, with plenty of martini in there to fill it up. But here, yes, they're battling over Star Wars. But the fact is, the Democrats and the Republicans have actually increased what what has been called for by the military. I mean, they are both in the pocket of the, I don't want to say defense contractors, because this is not about defense. It's about corporate welfare, and it's about military contractors like Norm Augustine, who heads up Lockheed Martin.
And also, Clinton also came out strongly in favor of three strikes, you're out, and all of these laws that are accelerating the incarceration rate, especially in inner cities. And this brings the specter of another complex, this jail industrial complex, that's becoming quite an economic power in this country and is also capturing the minds and hearts of the Democrats and Republicans.
That's right. In California, what, the prison guard lobby is the second strongest lobby in that state. Prison building is going on at an accelerated rate all over this country, as states say they don't have money for anything else. Chain gangs being reinstituted. Actually, Salim, you you and I were at that event the other day, a progressive event, the campaign for a New America. America's future, and Maxine Waters gave a powerful speech. She didn't quite do the same thing on the floor of the convention when she spoke from the podium. As she said, what are we doing in here when people like Gator Bradley are outside working with gangs, young African-American men who had gathered in the park? And she said, where are the organizers? Where is the concern for any inner-city youth and including them in this process?
Absolutely. And the groups that do emerge to represent these youth are demonized by progressive forces as well as the mainstream. In Chicago, there's a group called the 21st Century Vote, which has been attempting to have some effect on the political process and on organizing them, some sort of protest. But they've been pretty well marginalized by traditional civil rights activists as well as mainstream city officials.
Well, in the next few months, as we move into the election, we will continue to observe how the Democrats and Republicans have a stranglehold on organized politics. But there are some signs of hope. I mean, you've got new parties forming. You've got the New Party. You've got the Green Party with Ralph Nader, who did make a showing at the convention. We followed him around for the day that he was there. Clinton clearly not happy with Ralph Nader. And I think an interesting thing is that Haley Barbour saw Ralph Nader there and in the last few days has said he wants him in the debate. So we'll see what happens, and we'll certainly be bringing you those debates. Salim, we have to take a break, and then we'll be back with poetry from the protest pen. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and this is Democracy Now!, actually the last segment that is being broadcast out of Chicago as we've been here for the Democratic National Convention, covering what's inside and outside the United Convention Center, and I think that's an appropriate term for it, the United Center where the Chicago Bulls play. By the way, the Republicans put out a fax every day criticizing what the Democrats had said, and they called it Chicago Bull. But anyway, on let's see, what night was it? On Wednesday night, I went outside. I had actually just seen Ralph Nader, had been following him around. And when I was walking back to the convention center, I was passing by the protest pen. Yes, it was a lonely place. Most of the protesters here in Chicago had decided they didn't want to be penned in, and so they just took to the streets and went to parks like Grant Park, well known for what happened in 1968. But here at the protest pen, it was actually a quiet moment because there was so little happening. There was a group of Muslims who were there protesting USA to Israel, saying, look what's going on just here on the west side of Chicago and the amount of money that has been drained from here, and look at the $5 billion in aid that go to Israel. And then they started to chant prayers, and I was recording that. And it was very quiet because the delegates were all inside. The police ringed the whole protest area with this group of 20 people. And then when their hour was up and it hit 60 minutes, they turned the mics off. That's how the Democrats allow protest in this country and when they have control over it. So it was quiet there. And all of a sudden, a group of people came up, about 20 or 25, and a man came up and started to read poetry. And it was 60 minutes that I won't forget, and I wanted to be able to share it with you.
Yes, my name is Larry Winfield, and we are the DNC, Poetry Patriots, not connected to the Democratic National Committee in any way, otherwise I'd be reading these poems inside the convention center. A new poem that I wrote just for this little soiree, so let's get right to it. Here we are. hustling word slingers strolling through the valley of pundits, upscale anarchists, true believers, tabloid commentators, and another convention running smoother than the evening news. Is that why 68's getting more coverage than 96? We stand not so politely amid the glittering band-aid of the near west side in all its green, leafy, wrought iron splendor as we wait our turn, as we pretend to exercise the birthright none of us was supposed to have. Here in the official playpens of invective, we're expected to step up to the PC plate and slam nasty home run metaphors into the convention like water bombs splattering satisfaction. Should we believe we're really speaking truth to power, to the police, the politicians, and the press? Is this the same as blocking a line of tanks in the street, shouting, lecturing, a sack of groceries in our hands? Maybe. We do have a job to do. The summer soapbox is loaded down with outrage anticipated, outrage easily dismissed. Like the immigrant bashers and English-only illiterates who still crave the bargains slave labor brings. Like moralizing welfare reformers whose idea of tough love is throwing families off a cliff and suggesting they learn to fly while corporate welfare queens float serenely by on clouds we paid for. Like the children of a stupid God who burned down other people's churches in memory of the good old days. The purity-obsessed mongrels in camouflage and hoods clutching dog-eared copies of Mein Kampf and the Turner Diaries, too dumb to realize we've already eaten their souls and given them country music. We purge ourselves to the full moonlit sky and step back. Now what? In a one-party state with a right and left wing, it's hard to get worked up over the election. I'm still waiting for none of the above to make it onto the ballot. It worked for the Russians. I know. After the spectacle of a Trojan horse convention of multi-culti makeup hiding the same old fascist visage of those who'd rather die than be controlled, grasping for control, I should be grateful I don't have to choose a putative moderate Republican when a liberal Republican is already in place, but I'm not. Eternal gratitude is not the price of liberty we bought in blood and free chattel sweat. So, now what? In 94, staying home in disgust served its noble purpose, giving the rogue elephants 2 years of rope to hang themselves with. But this is 96. No time to turn my back. So I'll play the game with the ballot I'm dealt. I'll keep vigil with a jaundiced eye, because in the end, I still believe. Thank you. We had to do that for the next brother coming up, who is going to come up and read, a member of the Black Arts Group and a very substantial member at that, Mr. C. Otis Grant. Let's give him a hand. Come on. 5 minutes.
That's the Black Poets Group. Om. America. America. God shed his grace on thee and crowned thy good with the brotherhood of a select group of liars, cheaters, and thieves who use that brotherhood to form the most arbitrary and ambiguous history the world has come to know. Red, white, and blue, the symbolism of hypocrisy and bureaucratic stagnation. Men of power glossing the fault line cracks. In historical facts, red, white, and blue, those stars and stripes for never. Never again will I take a back seat, genuflect those my equal, sing that whining anthem or tatter my clothing with those tired ass colors. Blue. Blue is the mood that sweeps my emotions into a disastrous mist of color me sad. Color me gray, color me gloomy when thinking of those colors, patriotic white. White are the ghost-faced pointed hoods swinging my ancestor from the tree that fed life back into earth to breed in abundance the fork-tongued serpent, erecting sacrilegious torches in the face of the phoenix who takes flight up out of the ash, leaving that glow in its dust, its winged span spreading a shadow over hatred. And I see red. Red are my bloodshot eyes streaming tears down that flag shrouded in glory, glory, hallelujah. My country, tears of thee, waving embers across purple mountains majestic only to those who believe. While in the sky, atmospheric radiation beams down, singeing surf and turf, blistering the feet of the unprepared, running, running, running from those poisonous rays, seeking to alleviate your pain, caking your face with sunblock 2000, covering up your face, covering up your skin, covering up your history of bad blood and foul misinterpretations. Running from each other, running out of the frying pan and into the fiery douses of hell, and forever will you burn with those crosses of iniquity, and let those you've abused inherit your precious earth. So fly your flag in hell, till streaming down its acts of change and cover-up that have insistently been deemed necessary, and I will cry. Cry social injustice, cry racism, cry sacrilege, cry freedom from sea to shining sea. My tears will not provide you with escape. And you, your pointed hoods and your smoke and crosses shall burn forever, marching in the parade of hell's fire and brimstone.
All right, next up, who did have a little bit of parking trouble, but don't matter because they're here now. These three people work in public schools. I know a couple of them also have been involved in Gallery 37, which is a great, great public institution, and they also perform around the country. So I want to bring up right now Ms. Glenda Baker, Ms. Emily Hooper Lansana, and Mr. Karash Ali Lansana.
The wound of the daughters, the wounds of the sons, the wounds of the children of my people wound me too. The wounds of the daughters, the wounds of the sons, the wounds of the children of my people wound me too. Who will turn my head? Who will turn my head into a fountain and my eyes into a stream so that I might cry, so that I might scream, so that I might cry all day, all night for all of the wounds of the daughters, the wounds of the sons, the wounds of the children of my people,
the wounds of the daughters, of the sons of my people, of our children, our children, our children, our children, our children.
And those who are wounded will be rising up. Listen to the wounded.
On the backs of their plantation, new plantation industry dreams, we
the wounded will be rising
our
up.
Brothers,
none of us
we
are free.
Say, free Mumia, free
none
Mumia,
of us are free
Leonard
Peltier,
none
of us
Geronimo
Jijaga
Pratt, free Mumia Abu Jamal, free Mumia Abu Jamal, free Mumia Abu Jamal,
Mr. Clinton, I'm not talking about George here. Freedom is a road seldom traveled by those of us who live close to the white ivory towered lie, suit and tie hypnotized, niggas in suits and ties. But what about those of us on the pavement, close to the earth, living? How can $223 a month feed anyone, let alone a baby, a mother? Free.
None of us are free.
Who is free?
Until all of us are free.
No justice, no peace.
Thank you. All right. Next up, before that, I just want to say there have been a lot of different kinds of poetry readings out, and this at least makes another first. This is the first poetry reading where we've had so many police who've had a chance to hear what's been going on, and I appreciate it. Let's give the police a big hand for attending the poetry reading. Yeah. All right. Next up, we have the artistic director of the Red Path Theater and a very active brother with the American Indian Movement, Mr. E. Donald Two Rivers. Let's give him a hand. All right.
I'm going to read two poems, and I'm out of here. For Leonard Peltier, he's imprisoned in the United States government's jails. We're hoping that he's going to get out pretty soon. And on December 23rd, at Truman College in our space, Red Path Theater space, we're going to have a big party for him. So hopefully you'll come around. To Leonard, your name thunders through our realms. Our destinies weld together to walk in detours of conflict where nothing is clear, deception hidden in lawman's eyes. The women sing in sadness, warrior's eyes hug Mother Earth. A tear softens a defiant glare. This land's First Nations tired warriors watch you dance with gourd rattles in a tight circle. The hour recoils in tormented grief. At every powwow, your name is spoken on urgent lips. So much is at stake, an argument of principles.
Poetry from the Protest Pen, and that wraps up our week of coverage here in Chicago. Salim, thanks for having us.
Thank you for coming. I enjoyed your presence.
Even if we weren't on the guest list. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin, and we had help from WFMT with Don Mueller. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. With Salim Wakil, I'm Amy Goodman here in Chicago for Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!